climate change is impacting how we move around. As the world gets warmer, changes in precipitation and temperature are affecting our roads, bridges, and transit systems. And transportation experts are having to adapt how they think to make smart decisions for our collective future. This podcast is about how we get from here to there, exploring climate adaptation in the transportation sector, and the ways that climate data can make us more resilient as a society. I'm climate storyteller Rachel Molina Chan, and I'll be your guide for today's episode as we speak with transportation infrastructure specialists, as well as climate scientists and researchers who are transforming how we get from place to place. Please note that the views shared on this episode do not necessarily reflect those of climatedata.ca or its partners. Today's episode is a primer on adaptation thinking. We're going to hear from a range of different professionals from the transportation sector to talk about climate adaptation in the context of Toronto's streets. As you'll hear later in this episode, adaptation is more than making a few tweaks to the math here and there to account for a warming world. We're talking about a new way of thinking about climate variables and a new way of working together across disciplines to make the most of our decisions. Now, there are many professionals involved with adapting Toronto's streets, from stormwater engineers to traffic engineers. There are planners, forestry staff, and more. Each profession adds another piece of the puzzle, bringing a different skill set to the table, including landscape architects. On this kickoff episode, we're going to be speaking with two transportation professionals with a background in landscape architecture, Jane Welsh and Brent Raymond. We'll be talking about how climate changes are already impacting Toronto's streets, and explore ways to support transportation professionals as they adapt to these new conditions. We'll also be speaking with transit researcher Nabila Pratno, who brings us a lens on the people who use transportation systems, particularly those who face additional climate risks because of who they are or where they live. And last but not least, we'll be speaking with climate scientist Trevor Murdoch about the types of climate data that transportation professionals are paying attention to, and the climate data services that they turn to when they're planning for resilience. Let's start things off with Jane.
My name is Jane Welsh, and I'm the project manager for Environmental Planning Unit in Toronto City Planning. And the role of the team is really to develop policies to protect the environment and advance climate resilience within new development applications. I'm also a landscape architect, and in that role, in a voluntary way, I chair the Canadian Society of Landscape Architects Committee on Climate Adaptation, which is a group of landscape architects from across Canada who meet to solve some of the issues and to share best practices.
Jane has been working at the intersection of environment and urban design for 25 years, and today she is responsible for the preparation of environmental policies for the official plans of Toronto and Metro Toronto.
A landscape architect, we're always trained to think about the environment and the ecosystem and the way that the dynamic forces of nature all work together. So I do have an undergraduate degree in landscape architecture. And then my work got more and more involved in planning policy. And it was one way that you can really make a difference because you're changing, you're influencing the way, for instance, the largest city in Canada is building. And that's some work that we've been doing over the past 20 years.
So I wonder what kind of climate variables you're thinking about or looking at that you know are impacting Toronto's streets. What does climate change look like, or what kind of impacts is it having in that context?
Well, we certainly know, and we did a study a number of years ago to determine that we know that Toronto will have more heat waves. Right now we have maybe 3 a year. We expect that will triple over the next 20 to 30 years. And we also know we have many more extreme weather events. So how to prepare for those sort of flash flooding events that happen, and also protect people on the street. We want to absorb or allow for infiltration. We want to be sure that we're moving water quickly out of the way so that we don't get flooding situations, so that people can use transit or they can walk and bike or drive as they need to. We know also that we want to provide opportunities for shade or protection from the weather or from the sun and the urban heat island impact. In an urban developed city like the city of Toronto, most of it's built out. So you have a lot of pavement, a lot of hardscaping. So what happens with that heat radiates back up and then creates a microclimate where it's actually hotter there than the temperature normally would be. To address this, you want to provide a seasonal shade opportunities through plenty of large trees, trying to ensure that when you do have development applications that you have room for healthy trees on the site or the adjacent public realm. And we also have a tree equity study that's been done by our forestry division, looking at the city as a whole and looking where there are hotspots. That becomes a way that we can plan our investments strategically to know that, okay, this area you really have lack of trees, lack of tree canopy. If you look at a map in Toronto, if you compare income to hot areas, hotter temperature areas, we know that there is a connection between those. So we have to be a bit proactive in terms of programming around that as well.
That's a really interesting point that while we're looking at the city as a whole, you have to think sort of neighborhood specific to think about those needs and those risks that are posed.
We want to be sure that we expand that urban canopy into our backyards, onto our streets, so that we have an oasis or a relief from the extremes of weather that are only going to get more intense as we move forward.
Residents of Toronto, as you walk the streets of the city, you might feel the sun beating down and reflecting heat off the pavement. You might find yourself more likely to be caught in an extreme weather event, leaving you wondering if the buses are running or looking for a nearby transit station for shelter as the streets start to flood. So how might our decisions about transportation today inform the resilience of our streets over the next generation? Let's ask our next guest, Brent Raymond.
My name is Brent Raymond. I'm a landscape architect and planner and a partner at an architecture, landscape architecture, urban design practice in Toronto named DITA.
As a planner and landscape architect, Brent is interested in all dimensions of city planning, with two decades of innovative design projects behind him. He brings a unique perspective to climate adaptation and the climate variables that are most relevant to those designing Toronto streets. Can you tell me more about why this area of urban design is so important to you? And why is this an exciting space to look at climate adaptation?
As I developed my understanding of the overall process to street design, thinking about, well, how can we inform and influence greater change than just about the materials and the way that things are arranged within the sides of the street, I was becoming more interested in what happened to the totality of the street. In Toronto, 25% of the total land area in the total city of Toronto are streets. This is where people shop. This is where people congregate. It's where they meet their friends. It's where they meet up for a date. It's where they walk their dog. So all of these things happen in this particular space. The quality of these spaces is so critical to the success of a city.
As a landscape architect who's worked on cutting-edge design projects in Canada's biggest city, you have a unique perspective on just how high stakes these adaptation decisions are. Much of the infrastructure, especially in the downtown core of Toronto, wasn't designed to accommodate a lot of the extreme weather that we're already seeing that's influenced by climate change, and very unprepared to handle the challenges ahead in the next number of decades. And I'm wondering where you're already seeing the impact of climate change on Toronto's transportation infrastructure, both as it impacts actually how we get around, but also all these other uses of streets that you are talking about.
I would say that there's no city that has developed within North America in a way to respond to climate change, that it was never really addressed in the initial design of our cities. Streets were seen as transportation corridors first, but they're also corridors for water infrastructure. That conveyance of water is a major role that the streets play. The approach has always been, take the water that falls on the hard pavement, put it into a pipe, and then we'll deal with it someplace else, a hard engineering approach. And it doesn't matter if you're shifting the way that people move from cars to transit to bikes. If you deal with water in that same way, you're not really solving that aspect of climate change.
Our streets are vital spaces that connect us to the community. And Jane and Brent have introduced us to some of the ways that transportation planners and policymakers are already witnessing the impacts of a warming world. We'll be hearing from them a little later on about some of the exciting climate solutions taking root across Toronto's transportation sector. But first, let's turn to our next guest, Nabila Prietno. When climate change impacts our streets, our infrastructure, and our transportation systems, the risks are not felt equally by every individual. Without a lens on equity and the socioeconomic dimensions of climate impacts, we're not getting the full picture. Let's speak to Nabila to find out more about her research.
Thank you very much for having me. My name is Nabila Prayatno. I am doing my PhD at the University of Waterloo, and it's about transit experiences of equity-deserving groups.
Nabila's research, including her current PhD study, focuses on the experiences of groups that have been historically overlooked by traditional approaches to transit system design. Climate change requires us to redesign many aspects of our transportation system, and climate change adaptation is an opportunity to see through the eyes of some of the system's more marginalized users. I would love to hear more about yourself and just how you found yourself looking at transportation systems.
Yeah, so I initially started my master's in urban planning, and that was when I explored the idea about equity and transit systems, because transit is such a huge influence in our cities. They literally shape the social geography of where people live and how they work, how they carry out their daily lives. And so the complexity behind transportation systems is really what intrigued me. During my master's, I looked into the transit experiences of young adults living in the inner suburb. That master's were developed into a more refined research in my PhD, and I'm looking more specifically into the transit experiences of immigrant women in the Waterloo region. The geography has evolved similarly, where disadvantaged communities have tended to live more in the periphery where things are more affordable. And that really impacts their mobility, because mobility options in the periphery, there's really a lack of mobility options. You can't bike and walk easily just because of how the infrastructure is laid out. And it does limit the ability for people to carry out a life that they value.
That makes me think, with the group of people that you're focused on, immigrant women, we're likely looking at not just them as individuals, but their families and communities that they care for as well.
Yes, that is a dimension that should be looked at, right? It's the household structure, because a person's mobility doesn't only depend on their own mobility, but when you have families, then it becomes more complicated, right?
As Nabila describes, the edges of the city are where transportation systems start to be less connected, and this disproportionately impacts immigrant populations and people with lower incomes. When you're waiting longer for transit, when you're using it at off-peak times, you're more exposed to the environmental conditions of those transit spaces, and more exposed to risk if those systems are not designed with climate projections in mind. And this isn't just a hypothetical conversation for future generations to worry about. Toronto's transportation system has been confronting climate impacts for over a decade. Let me take you back to Toronto in 2013, when transportation professionals were faced with back-to-back weather disasters, flooding in July and an ice storm in December. The power was out at some transit stations for a week, interrupting and delaying transportation services for people across the area. Both of these weather events were exacerbated by climate change. So, where might a transportation professional turn if they're interested in understanding the data about these climate changes and how to apply that data to these once-in-a-generation decisions about the infrastructure we're going to build? Let's ask a climate scientist.
Hello, my name is Trevor Murdoch. I am a climate scientist at the Canadian Centre for Climate Services, where I'm the manager of data and products. I'm on loan to them from the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium, where I've been a climate scientist since it was founded in 2005.
Trevor is here to help us connect the dots from what we know about climate risks to what we can do about climate adaptation.
My start in climate adaptation really stems from people who were wanting to plan for taking future climate into account, coming to me as a climate scientist and looking for future climate projections. PCIC, and then now CCCS, climate services have this role of providing the climate data, trying to improve the relevance of the data, trying to make sure it's available in the variables that people need for planning, trying to improve the usability of the climate data for adaptation planning.
Trevor, tell us a little bit more about climatedata.ca.
So climatedata.ca, the purpose is to try to be as close as we can to the sort of one-stop shop or at least to be an entry point, a good starting point for anyone who wants to take future climate data into account. So it's a partnership with other organizations, especially regional climate service providers, who are providing future climate projections. They all have their own portals as well, but you can find links to them. So climatedata.ca will provide future climate projections across the whole country for a range of variables, temperature, precipitation, and indices of extremes. But there are also things like sea level change, and we're working on Humidex. It has sort of things that are used in design.
Climatedata.ca exists to support people like Jane, Brent, Nabila, and their colleagues as they think about how to create transportation systems that can weather the changes of Toronto's future climate. Trevor gave me an example of one data set in particular that helps transportation professionals adapt to increased rainfall: climate change scaled intensity, duration, frequency curves, or IDF curves.
From a scientist's perspective, this is a super elegant, cool tool that is used because it represents so much information at once. An IDF curve gives you different durations of events. So it's like the one-day most extreme precipitation event. Some parts of the roads will care about the one-day precipitation, but other pieces of the road are going to care about the most intense 1 hour or the most intense 15 minutes even. It doesn't matter if it's spread out over the hour, who cares? But if you can only handle so much during a 15 minutes. So different parts will care about different durations. That's the D. And then the intensity is how much rain you get during that duration. And then the F is the frequency, how often do they occur? So it captures all of this complex information. An engineer can look at an IDF curve and just take away so much information about how different pieces of infrastructure will be affected. Climatedata.ca, it has modules specifically designed for each sector. So one of the modules there is a transportation module. And the idea behind that is if you are someone who is keen to take future climate into account in transportation, and you have peers or partner organizations who are resistant or think you're just adding extra work, like what is something you can show them that tries to break down some of those barriers to adaptation and tries to facilitate, okay, here's how future projections have been used in other areas and other examples.
Climatedata.ca exists to be a useful resource to everyday working professionals who need to account for climate variables in their decision-making. And you don't have to consider yourself an expert in climate adaptation to start applying this way of thinking to your work.
Basically, every profession, every field, every sector of society that has figured out these specialized ways of operating, each profession has done that in a static climate. And we have to rethink everything. As people start taking future climate into account, they start sort of pulling on these threads, then the whole sweater unravels.
I think Trevor's right that when we pull on the threads of climate adaptation, we start to realize just how much uncertainty and change we're dealing with. It might seem safer to cling to the precision of the past, but the reality is there is no new normal. We have to think and work differently if we're going to build for resilience. Let's circle back to Jane and Brent and hear more about the opportunities that arise from this need for climate adaptation. So when it comes to resilient communities and transportation, I wonder if you could leave us with a couple of examples of communities or projects that are really making change and demonstrating some innovation in this space.
To me, one of the great examples is the design of Queen's Quay, which totally rethought how you have, you provide transit, you provide space for cars, pedestrians, and cyclists, and it rethought that, and then introduced nature-based solutions as well, introduced trees that were going to grow and be healthy into the space. Again, it was a bit of a rethink, and it's an innovative design solution, and that certainly my colleague Brent Raymond from DTA has been very involved in that.
Queen's Quay is Toronto's primary waterfront street. It started out as an industrial street serving the various water-based activity and rail-based activity along Toronto's waterfront. But back in 2005, we entered and won a design competition with our joint venture partner, Westate, out of Rotterdam, and developed a scheme where we would transform the street from one that was auto-dominated into a pedestrian and transit and cycling-promoting place. So we reduced the vehicle capacity of the roadway, we prioritized prioritize cycling and walking as the primary modes, all within a beautiful setting. Now, a critical part of this was the introduction of over 300 trees within the corridor, but planting them in a fairly innovative, at the time, soil cell detail that provided 30 cubic meters of uncompacted soil so that those trees could grow to a large and useful size. And this was building off of a lot of the work that the City of Toronto was doing, and perhaps more than any other city in North America at the time, to try to understand how to grow useful trees, not just plant trees so that they stayed in their root ball and didn't grow much beyond the size they were in the nursery, but to actually promote growth so that they could be ecologically productive. Nature teaches us so much. If we think of soil not as just the thing that you compact underneath a roadway and a sidewalk, but think of it as a living system that helps to actually absorb water in the first place, then we can start to think about how we introduce green infrastructure into the street to take the pressure off of the hard engineering approach.
Queen's Quay is just one example of how nature-based solutions and equity-promoting design can actually align with climate resilience. There's so much potential to reshape our streets through climate adaptation thinking. So why is this still so challenging for municipalities to do?
You know what the biggest challenge ends up being is the return on investment. Maybe it costs more. Maybe you have to move an essential utility in order to accommodate the trees, for example. So what is the value of doing that? And I think we have to understand some of those ecosystem values a bit more when we're planning these pieces of infrastructure.
Jane brings up an important point. One of the major barriers to doing things differently is that it introduces new costs. Is it really worth it to take action to adapt to climate impacts? Another way to look at this question is to consider the costs of inaction. In September of 2022, Ontario's financial watchdog issued a report outlining the costs of climate change to the province. The report said that on average, climate impacts are projected to cost Ontario an additional $1.5 billion annually just to maintain public transportation infrastructure. Without efforts to adapt infrastructure, this could have even more serious impacts in the long term. In a scenario where emissions start to come down mid-century, climate hazards will increase infrastructure costs by $2.2 billion a year on average if adaptation action isn't taken. In a scenario where emissions do not peak by 2050, the report projects that costs will increase by an average of $4.1 billion per year. Given that there is so much at stake from a financial perspective, from a safety perspective, I asked Trevor about his thoughts on how to put adaptation thinking into practice.
The first thing that someone who's thinking about, you know, how is climate change going to affect Toronto Street will do is they'll want a new number. Okay, so I've designed something for a certain number of days above 25 degrees Celsius. What's the new number? And that's kind of level one. It often seems like that's all there will be to it. But then it kind of leads to this realization that it's not just that I need to know what this number will be in 2050. It's already different today than it was in the past. And we're starting to have more of these sort of extreme events, like these are happening already now, that are, you know, consequences of climate change, or that are much more likely to occur because of climate change, and we're just really not prepared for them. So that second realization, oh, climate has already changed, and I need to factor that in, not just in a long way distant future, but already, how is our infrastructure not well matched for the current climate of today? And then there's a sort of corollary to that, a related realization when you put those two things together, is that, oh, right, so not only is it already different, and will be this separate number in 2050. It's not like we jump straight from here to there overnight. We're dealing with a range of climate conditions over time, and we've never had to do that before in the history of society and planning. We have always had the luxury of being able, for any given location, the variability that you have to care about, the coldest of the colds and the warmest of the warms, or wettest and driest, whatever variables you care about, is only the maximums that could occur at that place. But now what we have to care about is the mins and maxes of today, plus all the way out to however long, if it's a building, maybe 70 years, if it's roads, you know, however different roads will last different lengths of time, you know, stormwater infrastructure, whatever the lifespan of that is, it's a much wider range of conditions. It's the variability of now plus the variability of later and everything in between.
So to recap, climate adaptation may start with the question, what is changing in the future. But it also requires us to reckon with the question, what has already changed? Where are we already out of sync with the continuity of the past? And that question requires us to take a closer look at the new ranges of climate variables we can expect for a particular place and time.
That leads to this sort of fourth realization, which is that a lot of the approaches that we've had in society are, especially in infrastructure, are really hard infrastructure. You know, you design your roads or whatever it is to be able to withstand the most extreme conditions that could happen, period, over its lifespan. And that's the end of it. And what we need to start thinking about more is designing with resilience principles. And how do we keep our options open as well? Because there's one of the issues when you get into the long-lived infrastructure is that the conditions you have to design for, it depends on what we do if we as humans. So if we do get our acting gear in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, get to net zero within a few decades and hold constant, you know, limiting warming to a degree and a half globally from pre-industrial or 2 degrees from pre-industrial, we still need to plan. That's still a considerable amount of climate change. We still have to plan for that. But the impacts towards the end of the century of those levels of global warming as to compared to higher amounts of warming are, there's a big difference there. So you need to be able to plan for both of those options and keep your options open to the extent you can. So there's less of building hard, brittle infrastructure that just lasts for a permanent length of time and more of these, how do you build sort of resilience principles in?
Trevor's fourth point here is about building resilience by reducing the brittleness of infrastructure design. We don't know exactly what the future holds, but we know that the system needs to be more adaptive to a multitude of experiences over a range of potential climates. Just like with the Queen's Quay project, we can plan for multiple modalities, diverse abilities, and extremes in rainfall by drawing on nature-based solutions with the whole community in mind.
And then that kind of leads to this sort of realization is that actually, even though, you know, the individual professional's perspective, accounting for climate change might be annoying, time-consuming, confusing, an extra thing they have to do on their busy schedule. In many cases, I've noticed people finding that it can be a sort of a feature, not a bug. The resilience thinking, it sort of forces you to be more, think of a system as a whole. Systems thinking is part of that as well. And so it just forces us to explicitly design for nuance, to design for a range of conditions, not just black and white. It can actually kind of row in the direction of designing for diversity and inclusion as well. And so there's just a lot of like free benefits that go along with that, okay, it's more complicated, it's harder work, it's less black and white, but you get a lot for all of that. When we design things and continue to use historical data instead of explicitly accounting for future climate projections, we're trading precision for numbers that we know are not going to be well suited to what will actually be experienced. And so we want to use the future projections that better represent what will actually take place in the place and at the time that we're planning for. And the cost of doing that is we have to deal with, there's just no way around it, that there's some uncertainty.
Climate adaptation isn't just about changing one number here or there. This is an opportunity to reshape the way we think about how to get from here to there. I asked each of our guests about their vision for climate adaptation and their perspective on climate resilience in the context of Toronto's streets. Let's hear from Nabila first, as her perspective highlights Trevor's fifth point about the opportunities within climate adaptation to foster equity.
Including the lens of justice, understanding that underlying structures could really shape someone's ability to be mobile. We call that potential mobility. Our identities, it sort of intersects in interesting ways and intricate ways and influences our experiences, our perceptions, and even sometimes our behaviors, and how structural patterns really shape our institutions, the way we practice, the way we think about transportation. So really using that lens to understand how climate adaptation impacts different people differently, right? And we really want to be thinking about not only environmental sustainability, but also social sustainability in the way we think about climate adaptation.
Climate change makes me extremely nervous. I don't believe people are really aware of what's coming. Climate adaptation is something we need to do to make sure that we can continue to function as we adapt to our changing weather. So to me, resilience, I know it's a classic definition, but it's the ability to survive, adapt, and thrive. And I think the thrive part is incredibly important. And that means environmental resilience as well as social resilience. But if you have some of the environmental resilience pieces in place, you'll get much more social resilience, which can then thrive in the face of this incredible change that we're all going to experience. So we have to set the groundwork now in order for the city to be able to achieve that going forward in the future. You know, when we came out with fairly aggressive policies in our official plan around climate change in 2014, we had to explain to the public what that meant. And now, when we came back in last year, in fact, in 2022, the public was demanding that we do more. So there's a real shift in perception and understanding of what is happening out there. And that is really good because it's only through advocacy and challenging us to do more about it that we can actually shift this and make a difference in the way that we're building our cities. So I want to see us take these opportunities and thrive with them and build a better city.
It's not going to be a policy from upon high that makes this happen. Change happens at the grassroots. It happens at the municipal level. That's where projects get implemented. We need to do that in a better way.
I do very much see us going sometime in the next 5 to 10 years from a stage where, you know, it's the keeners. It's the, you know, the one or two people in each shop who are the most interested in taking climate into account, to virtually everyone in every profession has given some thought to how to take future climate into account. So that's the reason why we want to have a site like this where it can be a common entry point. If you know exactly what you want, you might just be able to plan there and leave with the information you need a few minutes later, or it'll plant the hooks for, I need to learn a little bit more about adaptation and what is all involved in this. There's a learning zone in there that has, you know, a lot of the commonly asked questions that come up when you're trying to take future climate into account. So portals like that continue to become more and more important.
Thank you to each of our guests for sharing your stories and giving us a more nuanced perspective on climate adaptation. I hope you take away that streets are vital spaces in our cities, and Toronto is just one example for understanding the high stakes of our decision-making. Climate resilience is in our hands, but only if we leverage the climate data we have at our fingertips. If this episode piqued your interest in climate adaptation and the climate variables relevant for your region of Canada, visit climatedata.ca for more. There you'll find information about the variables we discussed today, including climate change-scaled extreme rainfall data and heatwave data. If you're a transportation professional, we highly encourage you to visit the Transportation Learning Module. Thank you for joining us on this pilot episode of From Here to There, Climate Adaptation Stories. Just a reminder that the views shared on this episode do not necessarily reflect those of climatedata.ca or its partners. Join us next time and stay curious about climate adaptation.